messenger of God, and whatever he possesses is worse than an animal, said, Who will confront this dog? Thrice he repeated these words, and on all three occasions no one got up except his dear cousin, son-in-law, and divinely designated heir, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him. Some of the Muslims, who were actually the fifth column, instead of responding to the Prophet's call, started to praise the strength and physical power of Amr ibn Abdu'l-Wad in a bid to demoralize the ranks of the faithful, similar to what the self-styled Muslims in the service of the US and the West do today by extolling the military might of the illegal Zionist entity and the benefits for the Arabs to ally with the Israelis against Islamic Iran. The Prophet gave permission to the Imam to face the challenge of the Arab-Israelite warlord, saying, The embodiment of faith is all set to fight the embodiment of infidelity. The rest is history, as recorded in all books of hadith and history by both Sunni and Shia Muslim authorities. Imam Ali, peace upon him, after inviting Amr to Islam and telling him to live in peace instead of risking his life, conditions which the arrogantly ignorant pagans spurned, engaged in combat and won the fray. With a flashing stroke of his famous twin-bladed sword, Zulfaqar, Imam Ali, peace upon him, dispatched Amr to the netherworld, but not before allowing him to renew the life and death combat, because the cowardly representative of the Arab-Israelite force, when hurled to the ground, had dared to spit at him. That was among the reasons the Prophet had hailed his cousin's selfless feat, which was solely for the sake of God and without personal emotions involved in the combat, as The stroke of Ali on the day of Khandaq is superior to the worship of the Thaqalayn'd, mankind and jinn combined. At this spectacle, the Arab-Israelite force, which was viewing the combat from the other side of the ditch, lost heart. And as God Almighty sent strong gales to disrupt their encampment, the enemies fled. Thus, Imam Ali saved the Prophet of Islam and Islam from yet another nefarious plot, and of course, spared the rest of the Muslims, the weak of faith and the hypocrites combined, from a fight for which they had no stomach. The lessons of the Battle of Khandaq are all too obvious for us and teach us that the victory of Islam and Muslims is only possible through firm adherence to the path of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. The true path of the Prophet means allegiance to Imam Ali, peace upon him, and the rest of the blessed Ahlul Bayt in these crucial times when global arrogance, led by the great Satan, the United States, has in its ranks an alliance of the devilish Zionist and the reactionary Arab regimes for splitting the unity of the Islamic Ummah through cowardly crimes against Muslims and the rest of humanity. In commemoration of this glorious triumph of Islam over the joint Arab-Israelite force, Mosques were built near the site of the ditch in Medina, such as the Fath or Victory Mosque, the Mosque of Imam Ali, peace upon him, the Mosque of the Prophet's daughter, Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace upon her, and the Mosque of Salman Farsi, the Prophet's Iranian companion, on whose suggestion the ditch was dug at the vulnerable point of Medina to prevent the enemy from entering the city. Over the past millennium and four centuries, pilgrims to the land of revelation and local believers used to offer prayers at these mosques. Unfortunately, these mosques have now been destroyed by the heretical Wahhabi cult, which, despite its claim to be Muslim, follows Abu Sufyan, the infidel Arabs, and the Israelites, as is evident by the open dalliance of Bahrain, the UAE, Egypt, Jordan, and Morocco with the illegal Zionist entity called Israel, along with the secret relations between Tel Aviv and the Riyadh regime. We pray to God Almighty for the reappearance of the Prophet's 12th and last infallible heir, Imam Mahdi, peace upon him, and the establishment of the global government of peace, prosperity, and justice in order to end tyranny and root all these heretical cults, such as the Wahhabis and Takfiris, which have tarnished the image of Islam and Muslims.
علم فقه از علوم شریفه اسلامی است.
فقه or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of عمل انسان بعد از
Self-purification is the most significant factor.
امامت یک اصل زنده است در تاریخ اسلام.
امامت is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulema's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
بعد از مرگ ما با خودمون تو اون عالم جانمونو میبریم.
When death occurs, we only take our souls and its remaining to the other world. Our body and all our information of the brain does not go to the other world. Whatever you planted in your soul is transferred to the other world.
مرگ مرگ حادثه ای نیست که هر کی هرچی دلش خواست با خودش برداره بره اون بر.
Death is not an experience in which you can take whatever you want with yourself to the other world. Sometimes when we have a pain or anxiety, we forget some information. This means that the brain has a limited capacity and it is affected easily by a pain or anxious feeling. However, our souls are limitless and they save everything in it. Therefore, our souls are the best container to carry our feelings and deeds to the other world. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hojatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
On Saturday,
A gunman attacked a supermarket in Buffalo, New York, killing 10 people and injuring 3 others. Most of the victims were African American, making the attack one of the deadliest racially charged mass shootings in the United States' recent history. According to the police, the detained suspect, identified as 18-year-old Peyton Gendron, drove over 200 miles to carry out the attack. The law enforcement also said they were reviewing a 180-page document published online detailing the gunman's motivations. In the so-called manifesto, the author describes themselves as a white supremacist concerned about, quote, the dwindling white population. The document also says that he chose the area for the attack as its zip code has a large black population, which was within the driving distance of where he lived.
The inability of the unsustainability of neoliberal capitalism. So there's less resources, there's scarcity, there's a job market is being affected. Everyone is affected by that, but their interpretation of what the problem is different. And for white extremists, white supremacist extremists, they blame immigrants, they blame black people, and so you're seeing these ideologies that are emerging or mentalities, or not emerging. They've always existed, but they're responding to the intensification of the logical conclusions of neoliberalism and neoliberal capitalism, austerity, joblessness, you know, privatization, all of that.
The police are investigating the attack as a hate crime, as an act of racially motivated violent extremism. The teenager faces first-degree murder, a charge he has pleaded not guilty to. Among the victims were a father who was buying a birthday cake for his 3-year-old son, and Catherine Massey, a 72-year-old woman who was known for her civil rights advocacy. The tragic irony is that almost a year ago, she had written a letter to a local newspaper calling for stricter gun control measures. The Buffalo mass shooter managed to live stream his attack on a popular streaming service using camera gear mounted on his military helmet. Although the feed was taken down soon after it began, the issue reignited criticisms about the moderation of social media platforms. It bore striking similarities with the 2019 terrorist attack on 2 mosques in the city of Christchurch in New Zealand that killed 51 people. That attack was also streamed live on social media. The incident in Buffalo is considered the deadliest mass shooting in the U.S. so far this year. But some 200 other mass shootings were carried out since the beginning of January. Unofficial data suggests that over 320 people are shot in the U.S. every day. A recent report by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention showed that gun violence in the country rose dramatically in 2020, with homicides involving firearms surging by 35%, the highest level in 25 years. The report points to disparities in the rates of homicide based on race, ethnicity, and poverty. The study fails to single out the specific reason for such inequality, but cites the COVID-19 pandemic as a possible socioeconomic driving factor.
People having to seek their own interpretations of what's happening. We're seeing it like things like this shooting, and this is not the only shooting. There's other things that are happening where people are acting out, trying to figure out, you know, just acting out, reactionary, the most extreme reactionary responses to what's happening. And it can only get worse. As long as capitalism and white supremacy and patriarchy are the rule of the day in the United States, they can't address the fundamental human needs of people, then things like this will get worse. And then as the media glosses over it and doesn't want to tell people the truth, they can only get worse.
Tragic incidents like these are a grim reminder of the need for tighter gun control laws that would prevent easy access to firearms and reforms that would rid the U.S. society of racial and ethnic biases.
Okinawa, a Japanese island in the Western Pacific Ocean. The island was the scene of one of the fiercest battles of the Pacific War. It has marked the 50th anniversary of the end of U.S. occupation and its return to Japanese sovereignty after 27 years of U.S. rule. Okinawa returned to Japan on May 15, 1972. However, the island chain still hosts the majority of American military bases in Japan. It harbors about 70% of the U.S.'s military bases in Japan and more than half of its 47,000 troops. Many Japanese people, particularly Okinawans, are against the continued heavy American military presence and are protesting to draw attention to the issue.
Far from being reduced as people in Okinawa demand, the U.S. military bases have even been strengthened instead. We hope the rally will help people in the prefecture and in other places realize the seriousness of the issue.
The presence of U.S. troops in Japan is not in any way intended to protect Japanese citizens, but a part of U.S. military strategy. Frequent incidents caused and crimes committed by U.S. troops in Japan only make Okinawa more dangerous.
Hundreds of protesters from across Japan have staged rallies in Okinawa demanding a reduction of U.S. military forces in the prefecture. In the city of Naha, more than 1,000 people from Tokyo, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, as well as Okinawa held an indoor gathering to call for peace and to oppose U.S. bases. Japanese locals on Okinawa have already been expressing serious opposition to the presence of U.S. forces on the island. A poll by the Asahi Shimbun newspaper and Okinawan media organizations found that 61% of local people wanted fewer U.S. bases on the island, while only 19% said they were happy with the status quo. Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida, who promised to make a greater effort to reduce hosting U.S. military bases in the region, also acknowledged the issue as well as the economic inequalities that still make Okinawa one of the country's poorest areas.
50 years have passed since Okinawa's reversion to Japan, and the people of Okinawa still bear a heavy burden from the U.S. bases. The government takes this very seriously and will continue to do the utmost to reduce the burden from the bases.
A string of tropical islands located off far southwest Japan, Okinawa, has suffered massive devastation in World War II. Fierce battles between Japanese and American forces left as many as one-third of its people dead. Then around 30 years of U.S. rule followed. And Japan has not forgotten those days. Despite their opposition to U.S. troop presence, Okinawans are more concerned about the threat of a military confrontation involving China. Okinawa is closer to Taiwan than the capital, Tokyo. This could turn it into a target to be the front line in case of a conflict between the U.S. and China. Beijing considers Taiwan as its territory and views U.S. military provocations as a sign of support for those inside Taiwan who seek independence. American warships periodically carry out voyages through the strategic Taiwan Strait, drawing angry responses from China. The U.S. is also the island's key backer and main arms supplier. Tensions in Okinawa are likely to rise further given that lawmakers in the ruling Liberal Democratic Party have said that they want a commitment to more defense spending, including missiles that can hit targets on foreign soil. Missiles that could be deployed on Okinawa.
The United States uses its force and uses its bullying tactics to impose its will on other countries. So I don't know that in the minds of the Japanese government that they are really able to operate as totally sovereign, independent entities when it comes to going against the interests of the United States.
Considering the latest developments, Okinawa could soon find itself in the middle of another conflict, one that is reminiscent of a dark point in its history. And this time again, Washington plays a role in it. On May 15, 1948, the Zionist regime forced some 750,000 Palestinians to leave their homes and villages and expelled them into refugee camps that still exist in the occupied West Bank, Gaza, Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon. Armed Zionist forces massacred entire villages of men, women, and even children. That pushed rightful owners of Palestine to leave their homes and lands as they feared losing their lives. Consequently, that provided the ground for Zionists to establish the Israeli regime. The Palestinians were to suffer further when the West Bank and Gaza fell to the Israelis during the 1967 war, also known as the Six-Day War. Millions of Palestinians, including those displaced since 1948, found themselves under military occupation as well as further Israeli expansionism in their lands. Palestinians want the West Bank as part of a future independent Palestinian state, with East al-Quds as its capital. But Israel's settlement expansion and annexation plans have dealt a serious blow to any prospects of peace. The Gaza Strip has also been under an inhumane Israeli land, air, and sea siege since 2007, and witnessed three wars since 2008. More than 600,000 Israelis currently live in over 230 settlements built since the 1967 Israeli occupation of the West Bank and East al-Quds. That's while all Israeli settlement activities are illegal under international law. Every year, Palestinians reaffirm their right to return to their homes and villages in historic Palestine on Nakba Day. They hold annual rallies to commemorate decades of ethnic cleansing of their homeland by the Zionist regime to establish what's known today as Israel. This year, thousands of Palestinians and their supporters across the globe have taken to the streets to hold mass rallies in commemoration of the 74th anniversary of Nakba, or Catastrophe Day, and to condemn the recent killing of a veteran Palestinian journalist by Israeli forces. Shirin Abu Aghla was fatally shot by Israeli troops as she was covering an army raid on the Jenin refugee camp in the northern part of the occupied West Bank. Targeting the media organizations and journalists isn't an accident. This is systematic targeting of media to create a cloak of secrecy around Israeli crimes.
This is something that is extremely important because it is the part of the historical memory of a culture and people who have been subjugated by an illegal occupation of an apartheid regime.
In an expression of solidarity with the people of Palestine, the Iranian Foreign Ministry stated that addressing the issue of Palestine should be the first and foremost issue for the Muslim world, saying any attempt by global Zionism to drive the issue into oblivion would be doomed to failure. The Iranian ministry also stated that the anniversary of Nakba puts on display the failure of international institutions and organizations to resolve one of the longest-running humanitarian and political crises in the world. Israel has managed to get away with its crimes for decades as it enjoys Washington's unwavering support. The U.S. provides the regime with billions of dollars in lethal aid every year. It also invariably uses its veto power at the United Nations to block the world body's anti-Israeli resolutions.
Well, I think that the complicity of basically the Western political class in its entirety and the media in the West is inseparable from the question of Israeli impunity. Israel knows full well that it can do whatever it wants, that it can kill journalists, that it can kill Palestinian children, that it can continue with administrative detention and systematic torture of Palestinian prisoners, and that they'll get away with it because they will never be sanctioned by any of the so-called Western democracies.
This has quietly encouraged the Tel Aviv regime to continue violating the rights of Palestinians and to displace them and to steal their land. But how long will the regime of Tel Aviv be able to extend its illegal existence through carnage and plunder? Former Israeli Premier Ehud Barak has expressed concern about Israel's survival, saying the entity will cease to exist before the 80th anniversary of its 1948 establishment. the ultra-conservative former premier's comments echo prevailing fears in the occupied territories. A recent survey of young Israeli adults found that nearly half of the population in the occupied Palestinian territories is not optimistic about Israel's future, with more than one-third of people thinking about migrating for jobs and better life. Many analysts have pointed to the theory of collapse from within regarding the future of Israel, citing three factors of economic crisis, poor security situation and social divisions for the imminent decline and fall of the regime.
On Wednesday, two journalists covering an Israeli raid on the occupied West Bank city of Jenin for Qatari broadcaster Al Jazeera came under attack. Ali Al-Samoudi was shot in the back but survived. His colleague, Shirin Abu Akla, however, wasn't as lucky. The reporter was shot in the head and was pronounced dead after being rushed to the hospital. The attack came despite them both wearing vests with the word press emblazoned on them.
It wants the image of absolute lawlessness and operating with impunity. What could be more criminal than the targeted assassination? And just to say how strongly the whole world feels and the outrage at the assassination of Shirin Abu Akleh.
Also, according to eyewitnesses, the attack was unprovoked as there was no confrontation between Palestinians and the regime's forces at the time of the assault on the journalists.
The occupation is murderous and criminal. They shot us for no reason. We, a group of journalists, were there wearing our full press uniform in addition to the helmets with the word press written in large letters, as big as the whole world. We were obvious. We made sure to walk right in front of the army patrols so that they can see us and they saw us after we went to a road where there were no armed people, no civilians, and there were no shooting and no incidents there. We were shocked by the shooting. I was lucky and I turned my back when the first bullet was shot and injured my back. They wanted to kill me. I was injured in my back and the second bullet shot my colleague Shirin and caused her death.
But the regime didn't spare Abu Akla, even at her funeral. Israeli troops attacked mourners carrying the slain journalist's casket outside the hospital, causing the coffin to almost fall to the ground. She was later laid to rest in a cemetery in occupied East Al-Quds. The journalist's killing and the subsequent attack during her funeral were met with international condemnation, with Israel's closest ally, the United States, calling it, quote, deeply concerning. The United Nations human rights experts have called the incident a serious attack on the freedom of media and expression and called for a transparent investigation. The case of the journalist is set to be brought to the International Criminal Court, a tribunal that has in the past attempted to probe Israel's rights violations and war crimes against Palestinians, but failed to do so due to political pressure and sanctions from the United States. Israel's aggression against countries like Syria and Lebanon has also been protested in the international arena. But so far, the reactions from the international community have been limited to verbal support. That begs the question, will Tel Aviv face any accountability for its crimes?
Within international courts, because who controls international courts? And who controls the International Criminal Court while they're not even a signer to it? That's U.S. imperialism. So I don't think Israel will be brought to any kind of justice or accountability through this, but I think it's up to the people of the world, it's up to all honest reporters, journalists, and news services to make sure that this does not go unmarked.
Some observers, also ascribed the intensified Israeli pressure on Palestinians to some Arab states' moves to normalize ties with the regime. The Arab states had claimed that their decisions would help the Palestinian cause, an excuse that has repeatedly proven to be nothing more than mere window dressing over the past 2 years. Many Palestinians believe that in the absence of any international accountability, resistance remains their only way forward.
In the limelight. Brussels has vowed to respond with all measures at its disposal as Britain's Foreign Secretary Liz Truss sets out plan to make changes and rewrite the Northern Ireland Protocol. We now present you an article written jointly by Heather Stewart, Jennifer Rankin and Lisa O'Carroll. The piece is titled, EU Raises Spectre of Trade War if UK Rewrites Northern Ireland Protocol. The European Commission has raised the spectre of an economically damaging trade war with the United Kingdom, pledging to respond with all measures at its disposal if Foreign Secretary Liz Truss presses ahead with a plan to rewrite the Northern Ireland Protocol. The Foreign Secretary set out plans on Tuesday, 17th of May, to table a bill that would make changes to the protocol, including waiving all checks on goods flowing from Great Britain to Northern Ireland, where they are not destined for the Republic of Ireland. She said the UK government still hoped to agree the changes it believes are necessary, calling these comprehensive and reasonable, adding, "Our preference is to reach a negotiated outcome with the European Union. We have worked tirelessly to that end and will continue to do so." But she claimed the protocol in its current form jeopardised the stability of the Good Friday Agreement, which she said was under strain, and the government would act unilaterally if necessary. Liz Truss said, "To respond to the very grave and serious situation in Northern Ireland, we are clear that there is a necessity to act to ensure the institutions can be restored as soon as possible." Part of the government's motivation is to placate the Democratic Unionist Party, the DUP, which is refusing to enter a power-sharing government with Sinn Féin at Stormont, unless the protocol is altered. The Democratic Unionist Party's Westminster leader, Geoffrey Donaldson, said Liz Truss's statement was welcome, if overdue, step, that is, a significant move towards addressing the problems created by the Northern Ireland Protocol and getting power sharing, based upon a cross-community consensus, up and running again. Geoffrey Donaldson said his party would like to see progress on the legislation in days and weeks, and not months. Liz Truss called for the EU's top official in charge of relations with the United Kingdom, Mara Šefčovič, to be given a rewritten negotiating mandate that would allow the protocol to be revised. However, Mara Šefčovič responded to Liz Truss's statement by issuing a veiled warning that the United Kingdom could lose its free trade arrangements with the European Union if it went ahead. Šefčovič, a European Commission vice president who has been leading talks on changes to the protocol, said Liz Truss's proposals raise significant concerns, adding, "Unilateral actions contradicting an international agreement are not acceptable." He said in a statement, "Should the United Kingdom decide to move ahead with a bill disapplying constitutive elements of the protocol as announced today by the UK government, the European Union will need to respond with all measures at its disposal. According to Catherine Barnard, a European Union law professor at the University of Cambridge, the EU could hit UK goods with tariffs within 7 days of legal action or freeze the entire trade deal agreed with Prime Minister Boris Johnson in 2020. Two of three immediate weapons at its disposal. Legal action against the United Kingdom that was frozen as a goodwill gesture last year would probably be restarted. Liz Truss said the new legislation will be published within weeks, including plans to create a green channel allowing goods to be exported from Great Britain to Northern Ireland without checks, as long as they're not destined for the Republic of Ireland. She said this would create a dual regulatory system that encompasses either European Union or British regulation, as those businesses chose. That reflects its unique status of having a close relationship with the European Union while being part of the United Kingdom's single market. The legislation would also let the United Kingdom determine tax and spending in Northern Ireland. Liz Truss pointed to the Chancellor's recent decision to cut value-added tax VAT on green energy installations, which she said he was unable to implement in Northern Ireland. Brussels sources say no decisions have been taken about how to respond if Liz Truss does legislate, and express hope that Britain would turn to the negotiating table to discuss changes proposed by the EU. It was suggested that if the government tabled the bill, Brussels would issue a formal warning and launch a process to decide on retaliatory measures. European Union insiders believe that Britain has never seriously engaged with what they see as far-reaching proposals to lighten customs and administrative checks made by Maroš Šefčovič last October. However, Liz Truss dismissed these in the House of Commons. She said, "Their current proposals are not able to address the fundamental concerns. In fact, it is our assessment that they would go backward from the situation we have today with the standstill." European Union sources also point out that a change in mandate would require unanimous sign-off by all member states of the European Union. They said there was no desire to change Šefčovič's mandate to enable wholesale changes to the protocol, a matter Liz Truss described as a fundamental issue. The senior EU diplomat poured cold water on this idea, saying, "The European Union doesn't have a mandate, the protocol is the mandate." The resurgence of the Northern Ireland row with Britain is seen by the European Union as an unwelcome distraction at a time of tension and conflict between Russia and Ukraine. David McAllister, a German Christian Democrat, MEP, who chairs the European Parliament's Foreign Affairs Committee, said, "If you look at what is happening in the middle of Europe, a fully-fledged military operation, a horrible, horrific war, and we're discussing again and again issues in Northern Ireland, which I believe could be solved with a bit of goodwill in London." Richard Neal, the influential chair of the US Congressional Committee, who is heading to London and Brussels in the coming days in an attempt to supposedly head off further deterioration of Anglo-Irish relations, said Northern Ireland shouldn't be held hostage in the political process. Rather, all parties must stay the course and continue to work together to find durable solutions. Richard Neal is leading a delegation of at least half a dozen US congressional representatives to Europe amid rising tension over the Northern Ireland Protocol. Richard Neal's trip will take in London, Brussels, Dublin, and Belfast.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news, with delight.
Indonesians have held a dazzling event to celebrate Vesak, a day traditionally observed by Buddhists in South Asia and Southeast Asia. People gathered at the sprawling Borobudur Temple in central Java and released lanterns into the sky. That's part of prayers marking the birth, enlightenment and death of Buddha, a spiritual teacher who lived during the 6th century BC. The release of lanterns symbolizes letting go of negativity. The occasion lasts 3 days, which includes collecting holy water, sending off lanterns, and meditation. This year, the event was limited to some 1,200 people because of the coronavirus risk. Because of the outbreak of the pandemic, the ceremonies typically receive 20,000 people at the massive temple complex.
Tehran is hosting the 33rd International Book Fair in person for the first time after 2 years of lockdown as a result of COVID-19. This has caused enthusiasts to visit the fair for new titles. Saman Kujuri has the story.
The 33rd Tehran International Book Fair is underway in the Iranian capital, with over 1,700 Iranian as well as 170 foreign publishers attending the event. It is the first time after 2 years of lockdown as a result of the COVID-19 that the Tehran International Book Fair is being held both in person and online. As the top Iranian book event, the fair has millions of visitors every year, including thousands of university students, scholars, and their families.
I'm very happy to see that the book fair has once again opened its doors to the visitors in person after 2 years of lockdown as a result of the COVID-19. I love reading books. To me, the Tehran Book Fair is my favorite event.
For me, the book fair is an opportunity to get my kids familiar with books. I try to take them to different book fairs so as to teach them that book is a necessity in our life. I want to raise my children with the love for book reading.
A huge number of national visitors, along with international exhibitors from different countries, make this event one of the unique cultural events. The book fair is a good opportunity for publishers to showcase their new products.
We have designed our educational books based on augmented reality, which is an interactive experience of a real-world environment where the objects that reside in the real world are enhanced by computer-generated perceptual information, and students can watch educational films related to any specific topic. It will help students better understand educational topics.
It is said that books give a soul to the universe, wings to the mind, flight to the imagination, and life to everything. And this is exactly what the book fair tries to help you achieve.
By reading books, we feel healthy is the motto of the 33rd edition of the Tehran International Book Fair, which will be running through May 21st at Imam Khomeini's Musalla. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
A group of over a dozen penguins has been released back to the sea after being given a second chance to live.
The condition of these specimens, which fortunately could be reinserted, is very calm to find. They are animals that appear stranded on the coast, found with malnutrition, dehydration, hypothermia, and a high degree of parasitism. Specialists call this condition the stranded penguin syndrome.
The penguins were rescued and taken to the Mondo Marino Foundation, where they were rehabilitated. They were kept warm and were fed liquids until they could eat fish again. Before their release, blood and other samples were taken and a chip was implanted to track them. One of the penguins was a southern rockhopper, which is a species listed as endangered. Biologists at a rescue center say there are many reasons why penguins get stranded and malnourished. These include overfishing, global warming, and other environmental changes. Thousands of people crowd into the British city of Norwich to watch a 2-kilometer-long string of dominoes topple, while winding through town. Some 7,500 breeze blocks were set up for the event. The dominoes slinged through street buildings, windows, and even climbed up stairs and trees. The toppling lasted 30 minutes. The moving sculpture was installed across the city with the help of some 200 volunteers. The artistic director said the work was chosen partly because it was a spectacle and both disrupted the city and engaged its people.
There's a sense of anticipation that goes with the work. You would have seen people around town at the moment. Everybody's asking, what's going on? And then when they realise what it is, then there's this sense of, oh, and when are you going to knock it over? So that it's a sculpture also that gets destroyed in many ways. And that's really part of the work as well. I mean, I like to think about it as a child almost playing with the city. You know, they're setting everything up and we all know they're going to knock it down at some point. And that's fun.
Daniel Bryan said he was excited about the project because it looked like a child had taken over the city with the joy of knocking down dominoes. The cascading dominoes ran through two cities, eventually ending at the site of Norfolk and Norwich Festival of Arts. The organizers say the goal of the installation was to bring unity to the community.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Chilean paleontologists unearthed a rare, fully intact fossil of what is known as a sea dragon discovered from a melting glacier deep in Patagonia.
It is the first complete and excavated ichthyosaur that has been found in Chile. It also corresponds to one of the most complete fossils ever found on the planet for the Cretaceous period. It is the only pregnant ichthyosaur that's been found on the planet from the era between 129 and 139 million years ago. So it's incredibly important.
The 4-meter-long fossil is nicknamed Fiona and swam the seas some 250 million years ago. Scientists say this specimen will help them understand this species and its embryonic development. The expedition lasted over a month because of the remote nature of the find in the Patagonian glaciers. Paleontologists had to make a 10-hour hike just to get to the site. They also had to camp in extreme weather conditions while maneuvering tricky, rocky surfaces. But collecting and transporting the fossil was a whole other story.
As we went down excavating, weakening the rock, we realized the skeleton was mostly complete, so much that the bones were pushed inwards and we had to make 5 blocks of approximately 200 kilos each to move it.
The blocks were then airlifted to the Rio Seco Natural History Museum in southern Chile to be prepared for exhibition. The fossil was first discovered by Ruth Pedro more than a decade ago, but because of the site's harsh terrain, its extraction was a complex challenge. Scientists also discovered over 20 other specimens of the same species during the expedition, bringing the total found in the glacier area to 100.
Stopping by and listening to street musicians usually changes our mood for the rest of the day. The experience would be different if one lies under the instrument while it is being played. And that's exactly what a pianist in America has done. Colin Huggins, a busker, wheels his grand piano more than a half a mile from a mini storage to New York's Washington Square Park. He lets people lie down under the instrument and feel the vibrations from the claviers in their bodies. Colin says he wants to help people recover emotionally from the intense disconnect they had faced during COVID lockdowns.
I've always wanted to accommodate feelings in the best way possible, and I wanted to do it with music, and this is the best way I figure out how to do it. Maybe someday I'll figure out a way to do it even better, and I won't need to push this piano here. But as of now, this is the best I've got.
New York was one of the hardest hit cities by COVID in the U.S. Like other places, the major city imposed lockdowns and tough curbs to contain the virus. Despite that, Colin continued playing on the streets, frequently to an audience of zero. He says he strongly believes that everything will be okay. Cambodian fishermen aiming for small fish were shocked to see the surprise catch tied to their hook. This creature was nothing but an endangered giant freshwater stingray, which had swallowed the fishermen's catch. It was 4 meters long and weighed 180 kilos. The female leviathan is one of the rarest species of fish in Southeast Asia. Therefore, a team of international experts helped unhook the stingray to release it back to the waters unharmed.
All right, so we've just released our giant stingray back into the wild. She's kind of hanging out on the surface of the river here. It's amazing to be able to see her swimming around in her natural habitat and to have participated in the release of this giant stingray today.
The giant stingray was caught in the Mekong River, an important habitat for different species of fish, including huge catfish and barb. However, experts say the river's underwater ecosystem has been damaged by massive plastic wastes. Environmentalists constantly warn that building dams on the Mekong River is also destroying its large fish stock.
Scaling Mount Everest is only a dream for many and a once-in-a-lifetime achievement for most professional mountaineers. Well, not for this Nepali Sherpa, who has now repeated the feat for a record 26th time. 52-year-old Kami Rita led a group of other Sherpa climbers along the traditional Southeast Ridge route to the world's tallest peak. In the process, he beat his own previous record set last year. Rita first scaled Everest in 1994 and has been making the trip nearly every year since then. The Sherpa community is an ethnic group indigenous to the Himalayan region. They are expert mountain navigators who also carry heavy loads. Everest stands nearly 9,000 meters above sea level. The mountain has been climbed more than 10,000 times since it was first scaled in 1953. The bad news is more than 300 people have died trying. Chinese scientists are establishing a meteorological monitoring station at an altitude of 8,800 meters on Mount Komolangma, the world's highest peak on the China-Nepal border. The 13 members of the research team started the trek towards an 8,300-meter base camp on Mount Komolangma from a 7,028-meter camp on Tuesday morning. They reached the camp in the afternoon and went on the last section of the arduous journey up on Wednesday morning. It replaces the one at an altitude of 8,430 meters set up by the British and U.S. scientists on the mountains in 2019.
IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.